debated, you know, which hold all kinds of information.
You got to get the Israeli tanks out of the
way.
Right. And so I think most archaeologists right now are being extremely cautious because there's so much potential evidence there. And they don't want to commit themselves too far, you know, and come up looking stupid 20 years from now when a site gets excavated and we discover all sorts of things or they find some more manuscripts.
One tiny point of the scholarship that amused me over the years, they said, aha, Solomon had all kinds of phallic deities. And another scholar says, not at all. Those were the marble stalls for holding his horses. Let's see, sort of hits the horse to those posts. That's sort of the name.
Depends on what you see.
Right. Well, some
not necessarily on what's there.
Some interpretations are better than others.
Yeah, well, we have come to that time. And there won't be any bell today because it's Saturday and I don't know how the refreshment situation is. But the intellectual refreshment will begin once again at 10:45 here when Paul, I'm sure, will explain the current economic situation to you and will tell you why it is the way it is. And may even be able to tell you how to invest your rapidly depreciating money. What do you have left?
I told Paul one night, New York.
Paul, have you all read this?
I have.
Radical monotheism in Western culture.
I haven't read it carefully, I haven't. But
the Niebuhr brothers are really, I think, important in...
We spent a lot of time with Richard in ethics and Reinhold, I haven't read much of.
In helping to form a sense of historical consciousness. And I don't know anything that that I've read that as subtly kind of pulls you into thinking about the impact of the prophets on Western civilization, and I almost always try to get people to read that in order to get some idea of the sheer impact of the prophet's conception of God on the cultural community of which we're a part. And
light the fire.
Sounds great. The other book I want to plug really is von Rotz's The Message of the Prophets. There's a German school with a historian or tradition man by the name of Alt, historian by the name of Note, and von Rotz is the theologian, and he wrote a two-volume Old Testament theology, which does more to show that the way in which Israelite theology emerges out of historical periods. He has a conception of his unifying concept is of the word that speaks in each historical period. So he sort of to Old Testament theology what Bultmann has been to New Testament theology. And the section of volume 2 which deals with the prophets is out in this paperback. So it's there are 4 copies in the bookstore and the people who get them are going to get a gem. There's an introduction, the traditions of the prophets, prophets' call, the prophets' freedom, history related to eschatology. And then it goes on with a chapter about each of the prophets, and it's just superb. A question for for later on. Maybe I'll get to it next week. But start a conversation, sort of maybe by the end of the week or next week, on the question: Can Christ carry on a conversation with Muhammad? And I'd like to carry on the conversation with people who have done some reading in Gibb, so that I know that you all have some sense of Christ, and I'd like you to have a little bit of sense of the Muslim tradition, Islamic tradition. And there are a bunch of these in the bookstore. So you wanna?
Missionary friend of mine recommended a book by McDonald on Muslim theology and jurisprudence and constitutional something or other. I was hanging on to the book from the library, and
no.
I got a notice from the seminary that if I would send the book in, then they would send my diploma, and then I could be ordained. He said studying Muslim theology would have to help me in formulating my development of theology.
And indirectly, it raises, it's another way of carrying on the whole question of the meaning of prophecy and criteria for prophecy, because the Muslim community as well as the Jewish community respect and regard the Hebrew prophets as formative. There are two literary observations that I want to make just very simply and quickly to let you know how I come at the Book of Isaiah in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. I regard the Book of Isaiah as an Isaiah tradition. A hard thing for us to get used to, coming from a world in which there are copyrights for inventions, copyrights for everything you publish, is the loose, what I would call the loose notion of authorship in the ancient world. A good bit of our literature is unsigned. In other words, the author was not nearly as important as what he said, and what he said was in some sense a gift to the community, and so belonged to the people that he gave it to rather than to himself. There develops a large repertoire of very important materials where the oracles have become detached from their mothers and are really more important than the people. The people forgot about the people who gave them and remembered the oracles. So that you really don't have the tight conception of authorship, which means that what we call author, you know, when they say on the five books of Torah, the five books of Moses, that really isn't so much the author as the title or subtitle. So when they say on the book of Isaiah, that isn't the name of the author quite. It's the name of the tradition. So that we can find at least two different major authors in the book of Isaiah. Chapters 1 through 39 are largely, though not wholly, the work of Isaiah of Jerusalem, from which the tradition gets its name. He was a Jerusalemite, son of Amos, not the Amos who preached. He was perhaps a noble. He had conversations with important men. I think he was important at court and in advising the king. One might think of some traditions sort of try to make of him a kind of secretary of state. Whether he was a Reinhold Niebuhr sort of announcing things where they were heard by the king and his court, or whether he was an official of the court, remains a bit open. But we should think of Isaiah in terms of Isaiah of Jerusalem in quite much contrast to Amos, who's a manager of sheep who happens into Samaria. We should think of Isaiah as a much more refined, much more literate, much more involved in the politics of Jerusalem. So that this is the Isaiah of Jerusalem. 40 to 55, the language shifts, the setting shifts. One of the early group of prophets tend, who see on the horizon the demise of Samaria and then the demise of Jerusalem from the powers to the east, Assyria and then Neo-Babylonia. This group of prophets, because they see the hand of the Lord in the vulnerability of the nation, focus heavily on the sins, on the dry, I think it's Hosea, you know, the dry rot in the country, in Israel and in Judah. It's the, once this kind of destruction has happened, once Samaria has been carried away and Israel and Judah has been carried away, so that there's a remnant of Hebrew intelligentsia in Babylon, then it's sort of like the first range of very rough mountains they're over the top of these, and then they're seeing the more green, the more hopeful mountains on the other side of them, so that you can really, depending on whether they tend to emphasize the imminence of judgment or the imminence of rebuilding, depending on whether they try to shake people and wake them up before it's too late, or whether they are dealing with those who are a minority and have been through a kind of hell and trying to draw them into rebuilding and restoring and starting over again, you can sort of catch a different tone, a different emphasis, so that if the first round of prophets play in the minor key, the second round of prophets tend to be more in major chords. And so that Second Isaiah then makes much more sense. The 40 to 55 really makes much more sense if you see it over against people who have been through the war and need to hear a word of possibility, a word about rebuilding and so on. And then Third Isaiah 56 to about 66 is a collection of pieces, largely post-exilic, and unable to, we don't know, have a way of fitting them all together neatly. So, Isaiah of Jerusalem, the anonymous Isaiah, the poet who added his oracles, or whose oracles were added to the Isaiah tradition anonymously, and then the third collection. There's one very important advantage to this freedom to contribute your oracle to the community anonymously, and that's that some people who have some very strong things to say, their person doesn't need to get in the way. And there's some very important things to say that, although in general in our society anonymous letters are kind of irresponsible, there are times, I think, where there is a value in not being able to get rid of what is said because of some flaw in the person that said it. And there are all kinds of biting things that most of us have learned to argue ad hominem so beautifully that we can say, oh, they're a nut, or they're a fanatic, or they're a sinner too, and then we don't have to take seriously what they say. So that there is a real point to some words belonging to the community, and you're having to make up your mind about the words without knowing who said it. And so that this tradition of communal ownership of words has some advantages. So we've got an Isaiah tradition, and I want to deal this week with Isaiah of Jerusalem, who's this sort of secretary of state or wise man type prophet who preaches in Jerusalem rather than Samaria. He's a contemporary of Hosea and Amos. But when Hosea and Amos are preaching in the northern kingdom, Isaiah's preaching in the southern kingdom. And as he lives through the period when the northern kingdom falls and to Assyria, and so he is, as we move through the week, we will see him interpreting the implications of Assyria for Jerusalem. Okay, the second literary observation. I tried for years to get the storyline in the prophets. You know, I'd read and read and read. And I never could get it. You know, the next paragraph just didn't seem to fit with the preceding paragraph. Well, they don't. What you've really got, and some of we ought to publish an edition of the prophets with one poem on each page, just like we do when we publish poetry. These preachers were poets, or they were poets probably maybe as much as they were preachers, and so they'd write an oracle, and that was that. But when the oracles, of course, in those days, being thrifty about paper and parchment and all that sort of thing, you know, you just put one oracle next to the other one. And they were read one at a time, and you pause between the one and the other. So, of course, everybody knew. I mean, in the ancient writing, they didn't even put periods or capitals or anything like that. You know, you just learned where to put in your stops. So, of course, they didn't bother to all the versification, you know, and chapters and all this stuff. This has been added with Western tradition as a way of us making it easier on the reader, so the reader doesn't have to get as much oral tradition in order to make sense of the text. But the original texts are single poems, so that the first thing, you take them poem by poem, and it just frees you up immeasurably. If you realize that they're, just take one poem at a time and don't expect one poem to tie into the next one. So that we're dealing with an anthology of separate poetic oracles. That does one other really neat thing. It shows you what short sermons. They were, an awful lot of them were as short as Paul Hines, and maybe even shorter. And they knew. The way I would put it is that they knew that silence enhances the meaning of words, so that their They're relatively short pieces compared to our style of preaching. Okay, so much for literary observations, observations on content. And I'd like to read you a sentence that comes out of Martin Buber, which gives the title for the week, Theopolitics. Isaiah's Theopolitics is the attempt to bring Israel in a specific historical situation so completely under the divine sovereignty that it accepts its historical task to become the beginning of the kingdom of God. The attempt to bring Israel in a specific historical situation so completely under the divine sovereignty that it accepts its historical task to become the beginning of the kingdom of God. The prophets, Isaiah is wooing, courting, winning Israel into a sense of its vocation, historical vocation. These are oracles to a people, asking them to reason, to feel, to decide their life in the context of Yahweh, and to develop a politics, which is grounded in a theological vocation. The voice of God out of the thunder and lightning, the voice of the God that Israel didn't see, but heard in covenant, Torah, was heard again in these oracles, calling them to be political, to be a community, to be a society which had a sense of direction in human history. So that I think the word political is very important to recover us, call us out of a kind of ascetic spirituality where the ongoing life of community is unimportant and the inner development is important. Well, from the point of view of Isaiah, the call which originates in the covenant and in the inner echoes and the inner amens calls people into political life, into social, into a community which has tasks. A couple of the themes, Torah, like Amos, there's obedience, not sacrifice, a very curious one, and wrestle with the latter part of Isaiah 6, because there's a business about hardening the heart. What on earth does it mean that God hardens the heart? Instead of Amos and Hosea going back to the wilderness, to Exodus themes, Isaiah was in Jerusalem, there was the king, and so he goes back to Zion themes. So that there's much talk about Zion, namely Jerusalem, and there's much talk about the anointed, the Mashiach of God, the Messiah, who is a sort of reincarnation of David. The prophets are explosive because it has dawned on them that Yahweh is alive and that Yahweh continues to act with Israel like he acted in Torah and covenant. And their logic, their logic is a logic of recapitulation. So that they perceive that God is still acting, they expect new acts rather than everything to be finished, and so they begin to look at life in the light of Torah, to kind of go through a wilderness wrestling period, and they begin to expect God to act again with a new David, with a new covenant when we get to Jeremiah, with a new age, with a new, you know, there were 7 days of creation, and now there's another day of the Lord. There are to be continuing days of the Lord. So that there's a kind of, the prophets dawned on Israel with a kind of future shock. They opened it up. But the interesting thing is that when you open up the future, the resources you have for conceiving the future are in your past. When you begin to project directions for the future, you draw on past providences in order to find your sense of direction. So when the prophets begin to think about the future, they draw on the concept of day, which they knew from ancient, ancient times. There'll be a day of the Lord. They draw on, there'll be a new David, and there'll be a new covenant. So, into some texts. There's an outline in preparation, and the section I want to select from, there's a group of oracles that come largely from 740 to 732 BC. It includes chapters 1:1 through 5:30 and chapters 6:1 through 9:7. And I want to work on section 1:1 through 5:30. Just a quickie, because it's because I want those of you who missed the Amos Torah speech to hear a comparable Isaiah Torah speech. In order to appreciate the pathos in this, it's important to understand that everybody understood that the cult was Yahweh's. Everybody understood. The cult was not just recreation or was not just entertainment. The cult was their orientation, the maintaining of their intimacy with Yahweh, the foundation of their obedience in Torah, the context out of which Torah was taught and preached. It's important to understand that everybody understood that the cult was Yahweh's. Everybody understood. The cult was not just recreation or was not just entertainment. The cult was their orientation, the maintaining of their intimacy with Yahweh, the foundation of their obedience in Torah, the context out of which Torah was taught and preached, so that for the prophet to talk about Yahweh giving up the cult and rejecting worship and praise is not a philosophical distinction between ethics being good and celebration being bad. That really that worship is a waste of time. It's really the prophets announcing that God is at the end of his patience and is doing something to
to restore the meaning of life, so that you need to, it's important to hear this oracle not as somebody dividing and saying there are good things in life and bad things in life, worship is nonsense and justice is good, but to hear it in the context of someone who had been talking with Israel for several hundred years in its worship. Hear the word of the Lord, you, this is Isaiah 1:10. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the teaching of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What, to me, is the multitude of your sacrifices? And I think for us, we should substitute prayers, says the Lord. I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of he-goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring no more vain offerings. Incense, well, why don't we just say, incense stinks. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure, is the key. I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly. I cannot endure all the exploitation over here and then turning up for prayers as though it were all sweetness. And so we begin to see that, in this first section of Isaiah, it's even before the Isaiah call story. We won't get to the call story till tomorrow. The one of the places where he first gets uneasy and first begins to get some insight into the agony of the people is in the contrast between the utter impeccability of the prayers and the utter messiness of the communal life. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They've become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. Can you imagine that even Yahweh gets tired of prayers? When you spread forth your hands, I'll hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. For the prophets, they didn't think of God dying. They thought of God withdrawing. In which they experienced, they understood, or they thought that there were points not at which man would give up on God, but where God really was at the point of despair and ready to give up on man. So that the problem for them became this, what on earth was God to do when the covenant and Torah did not lead to the kind of fruit and full humanity that it was intended to? When you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood.
Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your doings before my eyes. Notice the simplicity, no argument about what's evil, just quit doing it. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, and then the one concrete definition of where to start, and that's the typical symbol of the dependent, more vulnerable members of the society. Defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. The next text, the next poem is 20, same chapter, 18 to 20, and I'd like you to, I want to read it because it should be written, because I want you to hear the voices of Yahweh. And the first voice in that Torah speech was the voice of the Yahweh who had grown, who had worn out and was in despair and was really confronting Israel, asking for a change of direction. The second voice here is a voice of the almost the lawyer Yahweh, the getting in there and pleading a case with the people. And it's really important to catch this voice, because the sense of Yahweh being able to reason sacralized the arguing about law, sacralized rabbinic tradition, made it legal to think in Israel. And because God thinks, then the people better think. And because God argues and God advocates and God pleads, this makes it clear and supports those in Israel who contend and who plead and who persuade. Come now, let us reason together. They had some absolutely gorgeous purples, and they were blood purple, and even better than some of our thin blood. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword. Almost like the old wilderness times. If you are willing, if you will follow leadership, if you will take direction, then you will be led into and enjoy the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you will become vulnerable to every passing crisis. You will become vulnerable to all the crises of scarcity and creation. You will be vulnerable. You will be vulnerable to the major powers and power struggles of life. I want to jump on to the Day of the Lord passage in 2:6. I'll come back to the oracle in 2:1 through 4, because it's a Messianic Age oracle. It's pretty important, but there's some doubt about whether it's Isaiah or a little bit of Isaiah or a little later than Isaiah, so I want to do it at the end of the other. 2:6 through 22. In 6 through 11, you have the definition of the problem. In 6 through 8, you have the definition of the problem. In 9 through 11, you have an announcement of solution. And in 12 through 19, you have, in 12 and 20 to 22, you have a description of the result. I'd like to characterize the two aspects of this logic as insight and foresight. When Isaiah noticed, Isaiah got some depth perception about the circumstances of Israel, and then because he understood the character of God, and because he understood something of his times and the power of Assyria and the vulnerability of Judah, he could foresee, not envision. Isaiah isn't really a visionary or a clairvoyant. He could foresee the results. Rottenness makes you vulnerable to decay. And if God is going to change a direction, he remains open to drastic reorientation of the life of the community. 2:6, and notice the description of Judah. For thou hast rejected thy people, the house of Jacob. For thou hast rejected. God has given up. Because they are full of diviners from the east and of soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike hands with foreigners. They have fallen from the enlightened ethical reasoning, the enlightened theological reasoning of one God, and the enlightened ethical reasoning of covenanting to the pluralism of superstition, where there's all sorts of incantations, all sorts of advice from 10 different gods, dozen different gods. They've fallen from the reasonableness of one God and one community to the, Hosea has the one image of a silly dove. You know, they'd fallen back into the situation where they were listening to this twerp and listening to this quack and listening to this voice, and so of course they're just wandering all over the place. Because they are full of diviners from the east and of soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike hands with foreigners. They're fat. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Sounds like they're stockpiling arms. Their land is filled with horses, and there's no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. The prophets just could not understand, once having been in the context of Yahweh, not that they didn't enjoy the work of hands, but they just could not understand why the people would go back to worshiping what they had created rather than worship the source of creativity. They couldn't understand how you could, instead of being open to to where creativity and humanity comes from, they were focusing on and caught up in the bits that they had done to fashion symbols of creativity and humanity. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. Then he begins to sound, what can you do about this? When you change your direction, and instead of being open to the sources of life, you begin to possess and hang on to and worship the makings of life, and say, gee whiz, we're big, look what we did. When you did it with what came from here, what do you do? What do you do? And Isaiah's understanding of this is that the option that God has is to topple Judah, to give them a sense of what it means to be low again, in order that they will understand the difference between faithfulness given a source and faithfulness out of their own. So man is humbled and men are brought low. Forgive them not. And then his advice, enter into the rock, hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the glory of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the pride of man shall be humbled, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. And then I'll close by reading this marvelous one about the day in which the Lord the new day in which the Lord has the tall and the great all over. For the Lord of hosts has another day against all that is important. Pride, not in the sense of gratitude and recognition of goodness, but pride in the sense of thinking that what has happened is just your own doing. Against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up and high, against the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, and against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the high mountains, against all the lofty hills, against every high tower, against every fortified wall. Can you see an ancient port with tall masts on the ships for the sails? Against all ships of Tarshish, against all the beautiful craft, and the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the pride of men shall be brought low, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. And the idol shall utterly pass away, and men shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from the terror of the Lord and from the glory of his majesty, when he rises to terrify the earth. They'll find bomb shelters and hide in the earth from the fire and
and the burning up of the Lord. In that day, then after that, men will cast forth their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, for the moles and the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, from before the terror of the Lord and from the glory of his majesty, when he rises to terrify the earth. Turn away from man in whose nostrils is breath. For what account is he? Yahweh, Yahweh, for whom as Israelite knew him, human life was the final great creation. The creation that in the image of God was to lead and guide and love all that was created before him. Humankind and Yahweh is ready, so says Isaiah, to even deal with and confront his humanity, his very own humanity in Judah, so that the goodness of creation will be restored and the possibilities of fullness be available for the whole universe. Tomorrow we'll talk a little bit about chapter 3, 5, and 6.
So this, for a recap, out of this sense of unity, goodness, sense of the good intentions of God, Isaiah, like the rustic Amos to the north, Isaiah gets a profound sense of the decay of Israel and Judah and projects the consequences of this. And one of his famous passages is Isaiah 3, and it's a magnificent portrait of the decline of national life. And what he pictures, when the prophets picked, many of them, when they pictured destruction, there are two things that they picture. There are two kind of logics. One is the logic of war. Many of their pictures are rooted in the what they see when the army had been through and captured the people. Another logic involved is what will happen if the people and Yahweh quit caring for. What happens is that things go back to wilderness. What happens is that things go back to a sort of normal chaos. And here's a picture of in which Isaiah pictures what will happen if God takes away critical leadership. For behold, the Lord of hosts, is taking away from Jerusalem and from Judah stay and staff,
the whole stay of bread, the whole stay of water. He's taking away the mighty man and the soldier, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder. Notice, all of these people are the connecting people. The people who are the connecting network that organize the community. And in fact, this is what happened with the exile. It wasn't the whole people of Israel that were carried off to Babylon. It wasn't the whole people of Judah, rather, that were carried off in 585. It was the network of connections, the connecting people, the people who could read and write and manage the affairs of the society. The mighty man and the soldier. Can you imagine a society without proper judges, without proper critics, without insight? The captain of 50 and the man of rank, the counselor and the skillful magician and the expert in charms. Isaiah is not a man of the 20th century, and he doesn't share the 20th century romance about youth. In most societies, it has been the assumption that if 10 or 20 years of experience were good, 30 years of experience or 40 years of experience might make people wise. If 20 years make you strong, 40 years might make you wise, and 60 years might make you profound. This is not the way we experience it, so it doesn't come as a shock for them to say that Isaiah to say, well, I'll make a teenager king. But for them, this would be a sample of, that's the last resort, because you haven't got, you need in leadership a certain kind of experience. I will make boys their princes, and babes shall rule over them, and the people will oppress one another. Notice, when the network of fair management is removed, the people will oppress one another, every man his fellow, every man his neighbor. The youth will be insolent to the elder, and the base fellow to the honorable. When a man takes hold of his brother in the house of his father, you have a mantle, you'll be a leader, and this heap of ruins shall be under your rule. In that day he will speak out, saying, notice now, the inheritance of power. The ancient world, sometimes the modern, the notion was that somehow wisdom might be transmitted in families, that to grow up in a family of a wise man would make the children capable of wisdom. So that it was a fairly, to have a continuous dynasty of leadership was a pretty rational idea. There was a lot of common sense behind the idea, but it didn't work all the time. Because a good many of us transmit more of our sins to our children than our virtues. And somehow the family doesn't catch the wholeness of people's life. But as a matter of fact, one of the differences between the northern kingdom, which was destroyed in 722, and the southern kingdom, which lasted till 585, is that there was a continuous dynasty in the southern kingdom. The dynasty of David did give a kind of stability, even when it was really lousy. The dynasty of David gave some kind of stability to Judah that left it a little less vulnerable. It also had the protection of geography and a few pretty significant prophets.